This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Jerry Smith, and we're going to talk about something very interesting, particularly in this day and time. Weather warfare, scalar energy, HARP. How are you, Jerry?
I'm good.
Thanks for coming on tonight.
Well, thanks for having me.
Took a while, but at least we finally got it worked out. I had you, what, 6 months ago scheduled?
Uh-huh.
So tell us a little bit about you before we get started so people will know who you are, where they can find you, and find your information.
Well, I am Jerry E. Smith. The E is for Elwood. I'm on a mission from God. That's a joke. But it really is Elwood. Druidic. The Druids worshipped the trees, thinking that since they were the oldest, they had to be the wisest, and I don't disagree with that in a bit. So I'm Jerry E. Smith, and my website is jerryesmith.com. That's Jerry with a J. You can find a lot about me and my books there. I have been a writer, researcher, activist my entire adult life. In fact, I started off, I was, I guess, blessed with going to a high school that had the system upside down, and the class that normally seniors get, I got as a freshman during an election year and became politically aware at 14. And found myself being an activist at 14, and I'd never stopped here at now at coming up on 58.
And your website is Jerry E. Smith, and that's J-E-R-R-Y, right?
Right, J-E-R-R-Y-E-S-M-I-T-H.com.
Okay. Now I'm going to ask you one thing before we get started. A lot of this, I mean, my show is pretty much a factually based show, so that's what people expect, and some of the things we're going to talk about tonight are factually based, and some of them are hypotheses or theories. So when we talk about something, for the benefit of my listeners, if you don't mind, I wish you would differentiate what you know to be fact and what you, you know, sometimes in your book you'll say, I don't know if this is true, but something interesting to think about. I'd like for them to know the difference.
Absolutely. I have no problem with that. In fact, throughout the book, I try to be very clear on what a fact is and where I got it from. One of the things I found in researching this book and my earlier book, HARP, The Ultimate Weapon, was that most people are unaware of the fact that there is an open scientific and military literature, that there are thousands of small circulation, peer-reviewed journals. You know, if you watch the 6 o'clock news, occasionally Dr. Dina Dell will come on and say, in the current issue of JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, there's a new study that shows yada, yada, yada. Well, so most Americans are aware that there is, like, JAMA and Lancet and Nature, but there are indeed tens of thousands of these publications where in scientific research, the rule is publish or perish. If you are getting grant money, you've got to convince the grant check writers that you're doing good work, which means you have to publish your work, which means it has to be seen in a peer-reviewed journal, and your peers have to say, yeah, that's good work, cut him another check. So there are these fantastic publications out there that are usually published quarterly or 3 a year, 5 a year, and they publish, you know, 500 copies, 1,000 copies, and they get stuck in museums and libraries and universities, and the general public never sees them on the newsstand. But all the stuff that I write about is from those publications. This research, this technology is being developed in plain sight, but it's being developed in plain sight if you look and nobody ever looks.
Right. Well, let's, why don't we start out by telling people what is HARP and what we're talking about when we say weather warfare, because many people have no idea that these things even exist. I probably didn't 5 years ago.
Right.
You know?
Okay. HARP is, I got to collect my thoughts here because I'm thinking 19 things at once. HARP is a field of antennas on the ground in Alaska, so linked together as to work as one giant antenna. It is today the world's largest radio broadcasting center, but it's not designed to broadcast for human ears. It's designed to inject an unbelievable, fantastic amount of radio frequency energy into a spot at the very top of the atmosphere so as to affect and alter that spot at the top of the atmosphere. The HARP is the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. It is it is officially the transition point between raw research and application. And what we're talking about here is the application of what we know about how the atmosphere works so we can use and induce conditions in it to make it do things for us. And this us being science in general and the military in particular.
Okay. Is it, I'm going to ask you what scalar energy is and what the difference, then we're going to get into all that stuff because I want to talk about both these things tonight.
Okay. Scalar is a, this is a borderline subject. Scalar may or may not really exist. Depending on which scientist you talk to, depends on what answer you get. Those who promote that scalar is real, there's only a handful of degreed scientists who are on this side of the coin. What they maintain is that, and this is very complex, and I'm going to try and give you just the oversimples of it. Let us imagine that there is an off-the-books physics, that there is the physics that's taught in the school, and then there's another physics.
Are we talking about quantum mechanics or something?
No, we're talking about something else entirely.
Okay.
And this something else entirely goes back to a number of things. Primarily James Clerk Maxwell, Maxwell's equations. Maxwell may have, in the 1830s and 40s, may have indeed come up with unified field theory. He wrote his math in tensor math, which we no longer, he wrote it in quaternion math, which we no longer use. At the turn of the century, by the turn of the 20th century, all advanced physics was being done in tensor math. And Oliver Heaviside, the discoverer of the ionosphere, and Heinrich Hertz, for whom cycles per second is named, they translated Maxwell's equations from quaternion into tensor. And according to several people, buggered it, left out pieces. Now, at shortly thereafter, there was the American physicist Whitaker. And Whitaker was one of the first people to show that the universe had to have more than four dimensions. Length, breadth, depth, and time. That the universe simply didn't work with only four dimensions. And did two major papers in 1909, 1910, showing that the universe had to have at least, I think it was six dimensions. Well, since that time, theoretical physics have been bouncing the idea around of how many dimensions there are. And I remember 10 years ago going to a planetarium show, and at the planetarium, the voiceover by Leonard Nimoy explained that the universe began with 14 dimensions, and in the first nanosecond collapsed into 11, and there are six or nine or however number there was agreed upon at the time when he cut the script. So what scalar is all about is scalar was a term first introduced by Whitaker in 1909. And this is the idea that energies, physics, phenomena, you can inject energy I don't know how to describe this in English, to tell you the truth, but it's basically cause without discernible effect, or rather effect without discernible cause. That by injecting energy in here, it comes out over there, as in very, very sort of Star Trek space warp stuff. and there's a whole bunch of stuff. And now I'm not that sort of a scientist. My scientific training is in geology and volcanology. You know, I mean, if you want to talk about igneous intrusions and subduction zones, I'm with you. On this electronic stuff, it's just completely beyond me.
Okay. I just kind of wanted to bring the topic into the public's awareness, mostly based on conversations I've had with Tom Bearden, and you bring up China a lot in that book, and he had, you know, I don't know whether it's right or not, but he had told me that China's scalar technology information was ahead of us at the moment.
China is ahead of us in a lot of things right now. One of the more remarkable things coming up on the subject of weather warfare about China is, you may know that in the last few months there have been a lot of news from China. Chinese have promised perfect weather for the Summer Olympics. And the way they are promising perfect weather for the Summer Olympics is they have an army of 37,000 people working full-time on weather management.
With something like Harper's Scalar. Because Tom had told me that the only problem that we have with it right now is that it's not controllable. It's either too much or too little, you know, feast or famine when it comes to that.
Right. Now, you know, I know about... I'm better schooled on the conventional and the semi-conventional. The scalar stuff is, I've been trying to wrap my wits around scalar for 10 years, and I still haven't achieved it.
Well, I'm far behind you, I can tell you that. I'm way behind, but are they using something like HARP? Is that what they're doing?
Well, what the Chinese primarily have been doing, very conventional cloud seeding. That's their bread and butter. Is their weather management for the last decade or so has been in primarily using cloud seeding to increase precipitation and suppress hail. And the way you suppress hail is you cloud seed and get it to rain out before the hail forms.
Right.
Because if hail forms, then it could destroy crops.
Educate people about what you're talking about when you say cloud seeding.
Cloud seeding is a technology that was developed by initially by Dr. Bernard Vonnegut, little brother of Kurt Vonnegut Jr., the famed novelist, in 1947. Dr. Vonnegut discovered that one could create a nucleating particle, that is something that had a strong affinity for water, and you could inject that particle into the air, and then vapor, water moisture, would attach itself to that particle, and more water vapor would attach itself to the particle until it became too heavy to stay aloft and fell as rain. That's basically cloud seeding, is you inject these nucleating particles into clouds and cause rain thereby. This actually was first attempted in the 1880s. The modern era of weather management actually goes back to the U.S. Civil War. During the Civil War, people recognized that great battles were often followed by great rainstorms. Now, today we know that what the cause was indeed the smoke and dust of battle created nucleating particles that raindrops accrued to and so fell as rain. At the time, there were a number of theories as to what was causing it, and a general in charge of an artillery battery came up with a concussion theory. He thought it was the changes in pressures that caused the rain to fall, and got the first patent. And by 1880, the United States government had issued two patents for artificial rainmaking, and dispatched a team from the Department of the Interior to go out and check this out. And the team spent a fantastic amount of money for those days. Their total allotment was about $26,000, which doesn't sound much like much today, but in 1880, $26,000 was more like $250,000 in today's money. And they established that under the right circumstances, they could indeed produce artificial rain. And then in the 1890s, there was a drought across the Western Plains, Kansas, Nebraska, and so forth. And that led to a veritable army of would-be rainmakers. Indeed, several companies were formed to make rain, and many of them were quite successful. But the public had a hard time swallowing that you really could do it, and the media had a hard time buying it, and so the rainmaker was a symbol of distrust and derision for several decades, until Dr. Vonnegut proved that it really could be done. And that has been the staple of weather management for the last decade, or for the last half century.
Well, I'm sure everybody's going to bring this, would like to know this question. Based on your research, we had a terrible drought in the Southeast this summer. We got to the point where, we weren't flushing our toilets, and we couldn't use water in our offices. And people, first thing people are going to say, if this is true, and I don't doubt it, I believe it, that it's done, because I've talked to enough scientists, but people are going to say, if that's true, then why do we have a drought and they do nothing about it? So that leaves two theories. One, we don't have it, or two, the government's doing something to manipulate the weather intentionally.
Well, now, this is very interesting. I believe it's HARP. HARP was finished very recently. In fact, a big ceremony in June last year officially cut the ribbon on it being up to full power. The work was actually completed late in 2005. They probably actually finished the work on it right around Thanksgiving Day of 2005, and it was announced officially on the website of DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, that was in charge of the program at the time, that they had indeed completed it. Now, I believe that HARP has been used to generate an anomalous high-pressure dome over the southeast as a hurricane shield. If you remember the 2005 hurricane season, mm-hmm. It was the worst ever, with the largest number of named storms and the largest number of Category 4 and 5 hurricanes making landfall. The next year, in 2005, they were predicting that the 2006 hurricane season was going to be even worse. And what really happened? Well, in 2006, we had this anomalous high-pressure dome stationary over the southeast, and not a single hurricane made landfall. The following year, again, we had an anomalous high-pressure dome stationary over the southeast, and what was it, one made landfall?
I can't remember, to tell you the truth. I'm going
to
rely on you.
So the last 2 years have been very anomalous. And those who know, in 2006, the weather talking head said, well, it was El Nino. Okay. There was no El Nino in 2007, and yet we had that same anomalous high-pressure dome stationary over the southeast.
Well, let me ask you this. I had another individual on my show a year or so ago, and I don't know if this is fact or not, so I'd like to know if you have any comment on it. They said that that New Orleans hurricane that came up the west side of Florida and turned left, and that we never have hurricanes that turn left. Turned left again, went out and hit the oil fields outside of Houston, and then went back, and then the next week or 2 weeks after that, we had another one that went almost the same path that stuff went on over to Houston. Is that true?
You can see the hurricane tracks from that year on Wikipedia. What I found most anomalous about the hurricane tracks in 2005 was that they tended to be straight lines, and hurricanes don't normally do straight lines. They normally kind of wobble and zigzag and go in big curves and arcs, and most of the hurricanes went in straight lines that year, which is very unusual. And with Katrina did something highly unusual that no hurricane has ever been observed to do before, which is just before it made landfall, it did an abrupt 90-degree turn and went down the beach. Now, I suspect what we're looking at here is that the hurricanes were blown in, probably using the Elite Technologies big wind technology, which I'd like to get to, and somebody else managed to get a hold of it and push it off at the last moment. I think we're looking at several different players in this game.
One more thing he said. He said that the clouds of the originating hurricane were square, like they were, like maybe longitude and latitude were, you know, put into the technology, and it made a square-shaped cloud in the energy grid.
That's right. In some of the official NASA photos, you can see some very strange things. There are several photos that show Katrina having a square eye hole, and that's not normal. And then there's another hurricane. I forget which one offhand now. It had a cloud bank over the eye hole, which is very odd, that formed what looked like the numeral 2 from space, which was nobody had ever seen anything like that before
really?
Either.
I've never heard that. That's interesting.
Yeah, and those are if I could probably flip through the book here. I know it's in one of the photo sections in the book.
So what were you talking about, the big wind?
Okay. Now this one, this is, the two, Wilma, yes, that's what I thought. It was on page 235 of the book. The book is a 400-page book. I have a photo of Wilma that seems to have the numeral 2 in the
Which
middle of
book?
It.
Which book? It's not in
Weather Warfare, the Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature.
I don't see it on 235. Oh, I missed back here something. 335, maybe.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Well, 225, I don't know.
Okay, anyway,
I found,
go ahead
I,
your story.
There we go.
Wind.
225, excuse me, 325. I'm a little dyslexic.
Okay.
So the big wind technology. You may remember that in the late 1990s, there were massive forest fires burning out of control in Malaysia and Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
A Russian company that had been a bureaucracy of the Soviet Union, when the Soviet Union broke up, it spun itself off as an independent company, calling itself Elate or Elat Technologies. Depending on which newspaper reporter you read, it either has an E at both ends or not. ELAT or ELATE. Elate Technologies went to Indonesia and Malaysia and said, hey, look, we have the ability to create hurricanes, or rather in that part of the world they're called cyclones. We have the ability to create cyclones on demand. You pay us and we'll blow out your forest fires. Indonesia blew them off, but Malaysia went for it and ponied up a never-disclosed amount of money, and Elate Technologies did their magic and whipped up a big wind and blew out the forest fires. Also flattened many villages and left a lot of people homeless. Well, it's possible that we have seen that big wind technology in use since. You remember Gulf War I. It lasted, 56 hours?
Mm-hmm.
In Gulf War II, the Allies expected to be in Baghdad by Wednesday. And what happened? The moment we launched, a big wind came up, and it was the worst sandstorm ever recorded, the strongest winds in 100 years, etc., that nailed Allied forces for 3 months, or excuse me, for 3 weeks. Now, I believe, and I can't prove it, I mentioned it in the book, but I can't prove it, so I didn't stick with it, but I suspect that Saddam Hussein went to his old friends, the Russians, and said, hey, can you buy me some running time?
Interesting. Food for thought, anyway. Definitely. So what would they do? Would they run these frequencies up to a really high frequency and then enter in longitude and latitude? Is that how they do it? How do they focus it?
Well, you know, I do not know. The Russians have never admitted how their big wind technology works. Another example of what Elate Technologies is doing, I give in the book, that is fairly well established, is there's a working installation of theirs in northern Mexico. You may remember for the last decade or so, there's been a pretty substantial drought,
mm-hmm,
along the Rio Grande on the southern Texas, northern Mexico border. And in the late 1990s, Elite Technologies cut a deal with the Mexican government to do something very peculiar, which, according to the American Meteorological Society, the AMS, can't work. It's just nonsense. It's hokum. And this is something that the Department of Defense, the U.S. DOD, was working on in the 1950s and abandoned. Now, what they have done is they've established platforms on the ground in northern Mexico that ionize or deionize the air above the platforms. The idea here is that you can turn anything that's in the air into a nucleating particle, so that any smoke or dust or pollution or anything that's there, by ionizing it correctly, that turns it into a nucleating particle, and whatever is available suddenly becomes cloud seeding material. And when they started, the reservoirs in northern Mexico were at about 20% capacity. And after 3 years of running the program, the reservoirs were at between 80 and 90% of capacity. And the Texans were freaking out because no rain was coming to them.
So if we really can do this, and I believe that we can, why does our country allow us to have the droughts that we do, like the one in California or the one we had in the southeast this year? What have you found about that?
Well, there are several things going on, one of which, from day one, from back in the 1880s, there has been an argument, a very loud and confused argument over whether it's okay or not, you know, whether we're meddling in God's affair or not. So there are a lot of people who think we should not in any way do anything about the weather, that it's God's province. There was a rather heated meeting at a Texas Panhandle, a government agency, a couple of weeks ago, where this government agency runs the cloud seeding program for the Texas Panhandle, and a number of the farmers had come in to say, no, we don't want you to do this. And of course, the government bureaucrats are going, what is your problem? I mean, we're here trying to increase more rain so that your crops grow better, and you want us to stop? What's going on here? Another problem that has arisen is the problem of unintended consequences, of damages. If, as I just expressed with the case with the Mexicans and the Texans, the moisture that comes up from the tropics comes up the Mexican coast and into Texas, and the Elite Technologies program is grabbing a lot of that moisture and preventing it from getting into Texas. That's stealing downrange wind, downrange water. If I make it rain where I am and you live downwind of me and you don't get rain, have I stolen your rain? And if I have stolen your rain, do you have standing against me? If you have standing, how much did I hurt you? How much of your rain did I steal? How much do I owe you? What are the damages here? And the United States courts have been unwilling to rule in this. The mainstream scientific media says very little. The mainstream media cannot agree because they like things that are quantifiable. They like to be able to put hard numbers on it. And you cannot put hard numbers on this.
You have to have the mitigation, for sure.
And so if you can't put a hard number on it, the science is not willing to put any number on it at all. And so this has been locked up in the courts for 130 years.
Well,
and so because you have mainstream science is not willing to admit to what's going on, you have it's a sort of borderland, somewhat rogue operation. You have government agencies at state and local and regional levels trying to do this. And you have independent contractors trying to do this. Many of the independent contractors have a rather apologetic stance that they if not apologetic, at least we are mainstream. At least within the weather manipulation in community, we are completely mainstream.
How does this kind of technology affect earthquakes and tsunamis?
Oh. No, that's a very small question with a very big answer. And I spend an entire chapter on whether earthquakes can be created on demand. And there is now the scientific establishment agrees that there are half a dozen different ways that humans have accidentally created earthquakes. By setting off atom bombs underground, by injecting fluids underground, by extracting fluids from underground, by building large dams and reservoirs, a number of things have caused earthquakes. There have been some intentionally caused earthquakes that are documentable. In the 1890s, Nikola Tesla used a resonance harmonic experiment in which he was used a steam piston to tap the steel girder of his building to see what would happen, and he got this thing, a nice rhythmic pulse going, and it went on for hours with no apparent anything happening, and he was just about to shut it down when he discovered he could suddenly hear breaking glass. And what had happened was is that he had found a resonance cavity in the sandy soil underneath central Manhattan, and that was re-emanating that frequency, and suddenly there was a wave of breaking glass going out from his office, and he broke like every pane of glass within a mile of his facility. And then in 1968, the U.S. Department of Energy was feeling the pressure from the Nevada test site, which you know is only about 90 miles from Las Vegas. And as the bombs at the test site got bigger, the buildings shook more, and the more glass broke, and the more people and buildings got rattled by it. And finally, Howard Hughes, who was one of the major players in Las Vegas casinos, flipped out and ordered the DOE to move the test site. And Howard Hughes had enough power behind him to where the DOE actually got the idea maybe we should move the test site. And they tried two other locations for the really big bombs. And the first location they tried in turned out to have one bomb, though they had planned on it being the new place to set off the really big ones. And this was in the center of Nevada at the Central Nevada test site. And there, that was Project Faultless. And it was called Faultless because they intentionally put the bomb on a fault line, but of course they were convinced that it wouldn't set off the fault, so they called it Faultless. Well, it not only did it set off the fault line it was on, it set off a fault line on the other side of the valley and dropped the valley floor by 10 to 15 feet.
Well, what evidence do we have, I mean, actual evidence that we have that HAARP has caused some of these damages?
There was, I don't have any verifiable evidence. There is circumstantial evidence that has been purported by a number of scientists looking at the HAARP project. Mm-hmm. But there is no for sure something. There's nothing I'd be willing to take into a court of law as evidence.
Mm-hmm. What about with tsunamis? Have we had any tsunamis that they think are connected?
Well, now that's a very interesting question. There was. And, during World War II, there were a lot of technologies under development that never got developed in time to be used during the war, like Howard Hughes' Spruce Goose. They didn't get the big plane to work until after the war's end. There was another one of those that was a tsunami bomb. Now, this was Project SEAL, in which an Australian scientist was on loan to the New Zealanders. And he was working in a lab in New Zealand and perfected a tsunami bomb, but didn't get it to work until 1946, and there were successful tests of it in 46 and 47. The United States was very interested in it. They invited him to go to the Bikini Atoll nuke shot to see if there was any correlation between his work and ours, and he declined the invitation. Some guys from the Pentagon went to his lab in New Zealand and sent back a very enthusiastic memo to their bosses that if the tsunami bomb had been perfected, they stated, if the tsunami bomb had been perfected in time, it could have played a role in the war as significant or more so than the atom bomb.
All right, and do this for me. Can you connect the dots, how all of this stuff back in the 50s and the early 1900s and what you were just talking about, how does that connect with HAARP, since that's only been built in the last few decades?
Well, HAARP is an example of the way I see it is that there was a watershed event, and that watershed event was the passage of an international treaty banning the use of weather as a weapon. That treaty is the Convention on the Prohibition of Military or Any Other Hostile Use of Environmental Modification Techniques, also known as the ENMOD Treaty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this treaty came about because the United States got caught with its finger in the cookie jar. The United States got caught using weather as a weapon in Vietnam. The United States, under Project Popeye, was attempting to extend the monsoon season over Southeast Asia by cloud seeding over the Ho Chi Minh Trail in hopes of turning the Viet Cong resupply route into a hopeless quagmire of mud. That when that came out, Congress, the United States Senate, investigated. The person in charge was Senator Claiborne Pell, Democrat, Rhode Island. Pell called then Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird in to testify. Laird lied and said, "Oh no, we're not doing any of that." 2 years later, a private letter from Laird got leaked to the press that revealed that Operation Popeye was real and ongoing, and Pell reconvened his investigation. But by this time, Laird had left his position as head of the DOD and was working as a private lawyer for Richard Nixon, who was fighting for his political life in the aftermath of Watergate. And so he couldn't get Laird to testify, but he did manage to strike a deal with the Pentagon, who agreed to a closed-door secret session. And in that closed-door secret session, they revealed that Operation Popeye was real and indeed had been ongoing for some 8 years. They had expended 47,000 units of cloud seeding material over four countries, North and South Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, the latter two in violation of international law, at a cost of about $21.6 million. Pell then demanded to know what else they were working on, and he was floored with a laundry list of insane things the DOD was working on, like how to intentionally melt Arctic ice, how to intentionally thin out the ozone layer over the enemy so that the enemy populace would be sickened through increased exposure to solar radiation. Pell then led the charge to get this treaty passed. Now, prior to this treaty being passed, the United States federal government was spending between $40 and $140 million a year, and had more than 700 degreed scientists working in developing environmental modification technology. After we passed this treaty, the U.S. budget went to zero, and these jobs vanished.
Wow.
Now, did we stop doing it? Did Uncle Sam say, "Oh, no, can't do that anymore"? No, it went to private contractors. In fact, the biggest company in the United States doing this sort of work is called Weather Modification Incorporated. They're out of Fargo, North Dakota. In 2005, one of the senior scientists from Weather Modification Incorporated went on the Coast to Coast AM and outed himself as having been one of the senior scientists on Operation Popeye. This is very real and very ongoing, and the United States realized that by putting it into civilian contractors who were not answerable to Congress, they could get away with doing off-budget what they couldn't get away with doing on-budget. Now, you asked about HARP. HARP is an example of environmental modification in the post-NMOD treaty era. We have changed the names, but we haven't changed the project. And so what HARP is all about, the United States Air Force keeps saying, we have no interest in controlling the weather. No, they don't. But they spend hundreds of millions of dollars in modifying the atmosphere. Now, you might wonder, what is the difference between controlling the weather and modifying the atmosphere? Well, it turns out that modifying the atmosphere gives you a whole lot more toys to play with, gives you a whole lot more things you can do, because the atmosphere doesn't just make rain. The atmosphere also bounces radio, and there's just incredible number of things that can be done with modifying the atmosphere. And that's what HARP is all about. HARP is all about being able to change, control natural systems to support DOD purposes.
Are you aware of any particular incidents? I understand we've talked about factual, but let's move on a little bit beyond that to some suspicions, maybe. Do you think that the government manufactured Katrina?
No, I don't. I don't. Again, I suspect that the 2005 hurricane season was a case of at least two different teams playing with the weather to see what they could do with it.
And who are those teams?
I'm sorry?
Who do you suspect those teams are?
Well, I really hate guessing games. Because, with guessing games, you have one or two right answers and a near infinity of wrong answers. The Elate Technologies is a gun for hire. They will sell to whoever has the money to buy their technology. So anybody who wanted to smack the U.S. around, if they had the money to buy Elate Technologies, could do it.
When they do that cloud seeding, they use chemicals like Dynogel. Wouldn't that be unhealthy for a human being or for life?
Well, no, Dynogel is something quite different. There's a company that makes something called Dynogel, which is primarily it is a polymer that can absorb like 1,000 times its own weight in moisture. And its primary use is like on the floor of garages to soak up oil spills.
Mm-hmm. We know,
but they have this bright idea that they could. I'm sorry.
What would that do to our environment?
Well, they have this bright idea that they could use it to take out storms and clouds. And there was a demonstration of it in which they flew into a cloud and released a handful of this stuff. Actually, released several hundred pounds of it into a cloud, and the cloud simply vanished. Now, they claim to be able to produce a completely non-toxic version of it, but that's not the version of it they used in the demonstration. And the completely non-toxic version of it, if it is possible to make, would be prohibitively expensive. So their other thing was they'd say, well, we're only going to do it over the ocean, so you don't have to worry about it. But that leaves me to ask, well, what about the whales and the dolphins and the other marine mammals? If it's a problem for us over land, it's got to be a problem for them over sea. But Dynogel apparently has given up on trying to sell their product and has gone back to making floor mats.
The other chemicals that are used, what does that do to our water sources?
Well, there are a tremendous number of chemicals being used. One of the things that has astonished me is that since the 1950s, there have been tens of thousands of intentional releases of barium into the atmosphere. At this point, barium is being released almost daily around the planet for a variety of purposes. And barium is toxic, and it increases soil electrical conductivity. And Mother Nature's plants have a trouble with soil conductivity. However, one of the curious things is Archer Daniels, Midland, and Monsanto have been designing designer gene species that thrive in increased soil conductivity. So there's a possibility here that there is an ongoing effort to wipe out heritage foods and replace it with Frankenfoods.
I've almost done that anyway. With genetically modified seeds, you know, it's, you can hardly find those things anymore.
Yep.
Let's see, what was that? Oh, how much does our average congressman or senator know about this stuff?
I would say very, very little. One of the things that shocks me about our average congressman or senator is I read some reports from the GAO, the General Accounting Office, back decades ago, and was just astonished that any of these guys get anything done. In that the GAO noted that the average first-term congressman comes into Congress, and I forget the exact number, something like $1.2, $1.6 million in the hole. You know, he has spent $1 million more than he had to get elected. Now, he gets elected every 2 years, so he has to raise enough, he has to raise the million to pay back the hole he's in, plus he's got to raise another couple of million to get reelected. The average congressman attends 7 fundraisers a day. 7 fundraisers a day. Congressmen don't do diddly. They run from coffee klatch to luncheon to coffee klatch. It's staff who do all the work. And the staff tell him when he has to show up and when he has to vote on something and how he's supposed to vote. And he buys whatever staff tells him to do.
Is there any pending lawmaking sitting out there that we need to know about?
There is.
8 minutes.
In 2005, Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson introduced a bill that got an amazing amount of flack, the Weather Modification Research and Technology Transfer Authorization Act. Now, that bill sailed out of committee and went onto the Senate calendar, where it died quietly. It has since been reintroduced from weather modification to weather mitigation. If you go to thomas.gov, the organ that will tell you where all the bills are and what their current status
thomas.gov?
is.
Thomas.gov?
Yeah. Thomas will use as your search engine weather mitigation, and that will bring up the current name of the bill and the current number and its current status. Both these bills would create a weather modification, or in the current case, a weather mitigation board that would have the power to pull together leading scientists in government and private industry who are already working on this, and put them into a board where they would then have the power to direct funds at promising research.
Do you recommend, since I don't fully know what it says, do you recommend that we support it, or?
I am on the fence on this one. I think the reason it died in 2005 was that the insiders, the military insiders, don't want? The military insiders don't want it to come out because this committee would actually know what's going on. It would actually be able to tell Congress exactly what's going on, which is a little scary, I think, from the military point of view. From the civilian point of view, there's an awful lot of people, like I said, who don't want any sort of fooling with Mother Nature to take place and are opposed to putting this bill together on the grounds that it would give the government a free hand to fool with Mother Nature. My major complaint with it is that the board it creates is a very lopsided board. It's only guys who are already involved in it. It's just scientists and civilian contractors currently working in the field. It does not include any other voices. You know, there aren't any representatives from ranchers or farmers who would be affected by it. There's a, you know, so there's a, it's very much a case of the foxes being requesting to be put in charge of hen house operations yet again.
Right. Is that the only one that's out there right now?
It's the only one I'm currently familiar with. There have been a number that have come and gone by the wayside, including Dennis Kucinich's space preservation bill, which expressly forbid chemtrails and weapons in space and use of mind control or weather control weapons. Had some pretty interesting language, and the bill got killed in committee and rewritten with most of the interesting language removed, and then died in committee again.
We got about 5 minutes, but now that you've brought up mind control, I would imagine, since everything's about resonance frequencies, and I know that word frequencies, you know, raises a lot of eyebrows with people, but if everything is about frequencies, then they could also use HARP to emit frequencies that could change state of mind.
Absolutely. I have been studying mind control. I wrote HARP, I first draft in 1996. It was published in 1998. I had been studying mind control from 1976 to 1996. And I spend a good third of the book on the history of mind control to lay out where it stood as of that point in time, or what was available in the open scientific literature. And one of the things that just scared the bejesus out of me about HARP was that HARP is designed to bathe the world in ELF, extremely low frequencies, at exactly the same frequency that the human brain works at. And I realized that if HARP was exactly what it says it is, no covert, no black ops, just some guys who know about antennas and the upper atmosphere playing with these things, they could inadvertently and unknowingly create mental dysfunction across a huge piece of the planet without having a clue they were doing it. And if they did know what they were doing, if there was a black ops program, it could easily be the ultimate mind control device.
Absolutely. I would imagine, too, we've just got like 2 or 3 minutes left, but it could also contribute to things like attention disorders or glioblastomas, brain tumors, you know, things that have to do. We know that MRIs feed those kind of brain tumors, that it's almost like food. They quadruple when it gets exposed to those kind of frequencies. So I could imagine that it would affect things like that too.
Well, one of the dangers of HARP is there are no biologists. Professors, scientists who have any knowledge of biology associated with the program. It is strictly guys who know about antennas and the atmosphere.
Engineer kind of people.
Yeah.
In other words, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And so if there is a biological downside to it, they know nothing about it. And there was a environmental impact statement, and the environmental impact statement is clearly doo-doo. It examined only the output from the towers immediately as under the towers, and never examined what would happen with the ionospherically generated ELF, which is the primary thing that the thing is supposed to do.
It'd be interesting to look at health records of employees, wouldn't it?
Probably not. According to the IEEE standards, they're all quite safe. The rest of the world are being fried, but the guys at HARP are quite safe.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, imagine sitting around a power transformer system.
Yes.
All those things going on and the things that it does to your brain, you know?
Right.
Well, listen, take just a minute again and tell people how to find you and all of your books and how to contact you and your website. And then we'll have to wrap it up because we're about to be at the end of the hour here.
Okay. Well, again, I am Jerry E. Smith, Jerry with a J, JerryEsmith. My two books that we've been discussing are Weather Warfare, The Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature, and HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy. They're both from Adventures Unlimited Press. You can get them at good local bookstores, and I'm not talking about the chain stores. Don't bother with Borders and Barnes & Noble. They don't like selling them. You can get them from my website, jerryesmith.com. At jerryesmith.com, there's a section on each of the books which will give you a lot more information about them. Excuse me. I've had a cold all week. which includes the table of contents, articles. Oh, I'm losing it.
Bless you. You okay?
Yeah, barely.
I just want to say, too, that...
Sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay. I've been there.
Yeah.
When
I've been coughing for a couple of days here.
When we talk about...
Right, I made it for the whole hour.
I just want people to know, if they want to research this, if when we talk about HAARP, it's spelled H-A-A-R-P.
Right, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program.
Right.
On the website, you will find the bibliography for both books. The Weather Warfare book, the bibliography is 32 pages long. Also includes appendices. I meticulously document where I draw everything from. And at any point where I'm going to go out on a limb, I tell you the limb I'm standing on.
Yeah, you did do a good job at doing that. You surely did. Well, thanks for coming on, Jerry, talking about a very complicated topic that's quite hidden in the world. I appreciate it, and maybe you can come back sometime.
All right. Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks, Jerry, and I hope you feel better, dear.
Oh, me too.
Good night.
Bye.
Bye-bye.